for the evening is The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. He received the Pulitzer Prize posthumously, was already dead, for the book. It has, as I say, a very excellent analysis of the young Kierkegaard, which was to be our special subject tonight, which is Chapter 5. Before that, he's developed something of his argument already in the setting up the kind of a human situation that confronts us from the present consensus of science and of religion as he sees it. And his concern, as he says in the preface, is that he wants to, as he says here on page 11 in the preface, one of the main things I try to do in this book is to present a summing up of psychology after Freud by tying the whole development of psychology back to the still towering Kierkegaard. I am thus arguing for a merger of psychology and mythical religious perspective. I base this argument in large part on the work of Otto Rank, and we take Otto Rank in the May period with the lifestyle in their reentry program. But he says, I base this argument in large part on the work of Otto Rank, and I have made a major attempt to transcribe the relevance of his magnificent edifice of thought. He says, the coming to grips with Rank's work is long overdue, and if I have succeeded in it, it probably comprises the main value of the book. Rank died in 39. His last work is a summary of his conviction that man is a theological being, not a psychological being, that the actual man, as man is, evades and eludes psychology. And he is subject to theological interpretation only. Naturally, the psychiatrist furious at that point, and yet that's the point to which most of them have come since, at least the Menningers among them. The Menninger died a few years ago. Before he died, it said, and it was the front page in our Minneapolis papers, that when are the preachers going to quit being amateur psychiatrists and get back to the proclamation? Because there is no hope apart from the proclamation, and psychiatry has no hope to give. And if you can only analyze the situation, no healing can happen. That can only happen in the category of hope. And that's something that has to be preached into man. It isn't something that's subject to man's own discovery and analysis. Menninger has written since, Whatever Became of Sin. And some of the very pathetic moments in this true sense of pathetic, not pitiful from the point of view he puts it, but man's own pathetic situation, is simply that he hasn't even got a handle for the self-awareness that comes because he no longer recognizes himself as sinner. And so he's left in a complete chaotic situation over against himself, only under the power of the lie and of his own pretense of character. It's not an easy book to get at, and I've been thinking and thinking about how to do this so that we neither wade to be bored nor drown, but able to swim in it. It has a tie-in with our last evening on Nazarman, certainly, in that he's arguing for a transparent and open relationship to oneself that allows life to become lived with its full vitality and not under evasion and boredom. And that's his fundamental concern. And this concern to free us for this. And he sees life continually under the terror of death, and that man never faces this, that Freud never faced it. That's his weakness. We refuse to acknowledge our actual humanity under finitude, under the fact that everything is the passing fair. The best presentation I know of this in literature is the cancer ward, where Solzhenitsyn, and incidentally, should the baby keep on being stubborn about coming, we don't want to overstay either, but then if we come back that week, I will deal, I think, with the Solzhenitsyn novels. And in the cancer ward, you have a woman who has replaced the previous superintendent, and she's a very effective, very capable, skillful doctor. But suddenly she comes to the awareness that she likely has cancer herself. and she goes to see the previous superintendent. And here you see the black humor that is throughout Solzhenitsyn's novels about his own setting, the Russian communist experiment, that you have a whole people given to chasing this rainbow with its pot of gold at the end, that's supposed to be a perfect society in which they're out to change the world, and they haven't faced up with a fundamental fact that must be faced by all men, and that is that we are mortal, we perish, we die. And this this old man who has retired says he realizes that a modern man, with all that he's achieved, has not had the maturity to confront his own death. And that's what he can't do. And that's really what the theme is of the denial of death, that this is what modern man can't do. And so he's continually subject to a terror that he refuses to name or face. And he tries to find himself by losing himself, as he reuses over and over again a superb phrase of Kierkegaard's, really marvelous, tranquilizing oneself with the trivial. Tranquilizing oneself with the trivial. I remember this great Hebrew thinker of ours, this Jewish philosopher who died here 2 years ago. What's his name, Mary? Yeah, Heschel. Heschel saying that aging in America is a continuous experience of being, see, how does he put it beautifully, of trivializing life with hobbies. That's aging in America, trivializing life with hobbies. Kind of an interesting phrase for those of us who can see that emptiness. And this makes me think it might be necessary for us to look at a few things first. Certainly, one of the little poems that comes to my mind frequently anyway about myself and my own present situation, it's the second of two Voices from the Meadow by Richard Wilbur, and the first is a tumbleweed, which is rather delightful, but I'll skip that right now. That's the one with no subjects and necessity at all. This is blowing all over the place. But the other is the stone. And the stone is saying, like cow dung under the crib of God, I lie where chance has placed me, up to my ears in sod. Why should I move? To move befits a light desire. The sill of heaven would fonder did such as I aspire. That's the normal mass man of our time speaking in that stone from the field, expecting nothing except another day, another dollar, which was one of the first words we heard throughout our prison camp from one of the older men. Howard Hong, in carrying out an experiment under the late David Swenson at the University of Minnesota, had as his project to confront people in the streetcars, as we had them then, no buses back there in the 30s, and on the street and in various places, just to ask people, what are you living for? He was hit by one man with his fist, he was spit at, and people said with anger as they were asked, what do you suppose? Make a buck, of course. Well, obviously, you got yourself tranquilized with the trivial there, and to be even confronted by the fact that you're just a stone in a field and refusing to move is enough to make people react with some fury. He was surprised at the fury that was aroused by that simple question which he asked everybody for a period of time in the streets of Minneapolis. What are you living for? Well, if you're only living in order to keep the wheels moving, you know, and you don't even know where you're going with the old automobile, it's pretty rough, isn't it? Just to keep everything moving, to get up for another day for another dollar. And that is the aspect of life over against which he is confronting, and which he believes that Kierkegaard has confronted with greater efficacy than anybody in our Western society who is available to the techniques of the 20th century man. In other words, he comes out the same place where clinical psychologists do in his analysis of man. So I thought we'd better look briefly again at the two in the way in which they analyze our human situation, just so we get the overarching structures against which we can place our thinking and see some of the things that are said. Once more, renewing ourself, as I mentioned last time, with Becker. Becker follows the particular understanding of the human situation that is put by Tillich in under three categories. That man is, first of all, finding himself under the basic category of auto nomenos living, autonomy, auto, we had Greek today, that's self, self-rule. Under self-rule, he uses structures from rank here at this point and also from others. The phrase that he most frequently uses for it is from Spinoza, causa sui. I used to call this King of the Hill. Everybody's playing King of the Hill and thinks he's King of the Hill until somebody beard comes along and knocks you down, you're there. It's our college president had a little joke about that for all of us students caught up on that. He says, so many of us are like that drunk Norwegian that came into the tavern and said, I can lick anybody in the county. And the first guy gets up and knocked him down. He says, I guess I took in too much territory. We aren't quite the gods we think we are. And that comes, fortunately, to people, if they've been fortunate enough to be elected the president of their class or the homecoming queen, so that high school becomes life in miniature and you realize how really stupid and shallow and superficial that whole arena is. I got sent by my teachers to the principal. The principal pled with me in high school to hold in there. My last half of my senior year, I was absent for 39 times, any excuse I could find. I happened to have been the highest in scholarship amongst the guys in my time, and he said I was destroying the whole system. All I was asking is, what's it all about? What's it for? That question, he says, is illegitimate and does not belong in American high school. The object is to get A's, of course, to make a dollar. Fortunate are those who get busted under that, of course, who see this isn't it. But then they get caught under a second category, according to Becker and according to Tillich, and they're found then in the category of heteronomy. Heteros is the other, two words for other. In Greek, this is really the other of a different kind. But the other of a different kind for me personally, but he's still an Einer vom Unser, as the Germans use the phrase. He's one of our own. You deify your particular group. You make a group ego which you worship out of your particular group. I might not be even in the athletic situation, but we got the greatest team here in this high school. We got the finest college in America, this kind of group ego thing, which is rather absurd and can be laughed at that level, but it gets to be rather serious. As you see, Missouri Synod split over it, and they have actually written their books. They're the one true church. They have a book on it, one of their theologians discussing this. We are the one true church. And when you create your little, when you cross your little T's, as one of our great grand thinkers that I've mentioned before, Skidscore, one of the beautiful guys, really, the one that's responsible for the fact that we start here with celebration. By the way, it's still on our motion as a board and scared me to death for my successor, you might let it go, because the board has said there shall be no celebration of the sacrament of the altar here in the village. The fact that we've got a church now, they can't stop us. But they did that to protect themselves against the group egos of the various synods, which will not even recognize each other at that moment, except under certain circumstances. Fortunately, the ALC recognized both the others, so our church relates in that way to them. But here, as you know, we refuse to recognize any kind of condition at that moment, and though there are other churches now that have followed suit and follow our lead at this point, I remember the first national convention of the LCA definitely put up a closed communion as the way that we would operate in America. And this, for our European friends that come over, is a great offense to them, that they have to sign a little card before they go up to communion saying, I belong to such a church, so on. It's unthinkable, of course, in the European setting. But that the communion is there for all, and that you can't put a trademark on it that says, this is Luther's table. It's the Lord's table. But this kind of a destruction of community that's come out of group ego, he deals with an escape from evil in a very graphic and I think exciting way that's, for me at least, a more profound and timely book than this one, and not as difficult to get at. But those group egos are more difficult to see. We can see the other person's group ego as ridiculous. The Russians to the communist system, of course, for us is a ridiculous one. And the Germans to Hitler was a tyranny that became destructive for looking like our whole planet was going to collapse under it, as you recall. There's an intense kind of energy that becomes explosive under the group egos. And this is their demonic nature, the demonic kind of shapes of them, that they overwhelm the individual involved in them and his own capacity to stop it or to even change in any way or qualify its direction. These he deals with later. But you have that second category. But fortunate the person, again, who sees that that isn't going to work either, you see. Unfortunately, in our American scene, for some of us, it gets to be like my great group ego, the idol of my life was women. They were perfect and beautiful, and you would find a girl that couldn't be kissed, and I found one. And I made myself a whole big ass on it, of course. One of the other guys in my class, at the instigation of the rest of the guys in my class in St. Elm, took her out, kissed the first night, sworn a stack of Bibles he had, and there went my idol. And it was a good idol to go. But that had to be cleared out of my system before I was ready for any confrontation with something more basic for myself than just an ideal of that kind under which you put your living. But this second category of that heteronomous, then, the only way that can be broken through is the problem which he discusses here with Kierkegaard and with Rank. He uses these two especially, and that he's discussing this. And the miracle in which that can be broken through to become theonomous, for one is subject and under that subject to the God who creates and makes us, to the one who is the God of creation, a new kind of surge of creativity comes and a new kind of possibility in the category of freedom. And that is the ultimate hope that he has, that can happen for man. It can be reborn to that kind of a mere beginning, and deal with himself as a mere beginning, to use Luther's words there, and which he also uses. But and where he no longer has these preposterous, idolatrous notions of himself, and is himself not bounded by necessity, and so he becomes a real case for a psychiatrist. Finally, he thinks he's Jesus Christ or God on one side of the picture, or in despair from that side, he's a worm and nothing, and he takes the opposite kind. And he lives in that despair, which, as he says, can only lead finally to self-destruction in one way or another. Now, this is the categories that we're dealing with Becker, and he's using them, as he says, in his own deathbed. He identifies with Luther and trust and hope. He has some good quotes from Luther, even in this book. His knowledge of Luther is not as wide as you could wish. A lot of it is secondary from Tillich. It still remains that he sees the only hope at this point, and he feels Rank, too, has done a beautiful job of making a closure on Christianity, ideally speaking, not the Christianity of the churches, which is protective and seeking its own safety and settles for tranquility and tranquilizing others with the trivial and the parish affairs, but the appeal to the heroic in man that is essential to the Christian witness. Kierkegaard has a different way of putting the whole structure of our human situation, and perhaps this is as good a place to review this for some of you and to introduce it to others. This basic man caught simply in that causa sui, where he's his own cause and then only escapes from it as an echo to others and to his peer group, that whole level Kierkegaard calls aesthetic. The aesthetic level of simple feeling, the level of escape from any kind of real demand on myself in any way for the heroic. I make a living, I take care of my family, I'm not causing any trouble, the cops can't get at me, leave me alone. This basic level is, however, a level of boredom. And man is caught in it and continually then in his endeavor to escape from the boredom comes under this aesthetic also, and he deals with Don Juan and those figures of that kind of an escape from boredom that is one that most of our society picks, the sex image, etc. But the impossibility for man being as he is, a continuous duality, a continuous conflict person between spirit and flesh. He can't get away with it. He simply can't get away with it. He can't stand his own disgust. It's there. And so he will be drawn out of that kind of a futility of escape by saying it's got to be more. And that more, it becomes the ethical. Giving himself a sobriety to something larger than himself. Giving himself to causes that are more than his own daily intake of food need of sex, etc. He becomes a person concerned, a citizen, a judge represents this, and so on. There's only one problem if you've got at that level of ethical still, too. It's not only that there's continuous self-deception, this character of the lie, you build yourself a character, and that's a lie, because you aren't what you claim or seem to be, and all societies seem to be built on that same kind of a lie, where we're all phonies playing games with each other, and it's very dull. And that's its problem, it is dull. And the dullness is all. And in dealing with ourselves at that ethical level, because there's so much self-deceit, we're always in danger of being caught up in our lie, realizing who are we fooling. And fortune is a person who sees that. And when that happens to them, he does seek us out. The only alternative that seems to remain, that's the religious. However, there are two categories of the religious. There's still the religious of the good man now, who is seeking a larger kind of context than himself, his own ethical endeavor and so on, in which to place the perspective of his life. And he becomes another kind of a plane at religion. And this religion A, as he calls it, is the social structures, the ecclesiastical structures, the hierarchical structures, the establishment aspect of the religious. And the problem there again is you're still a phony, and who are you fooling? And fortunately, at this point, there comes a kind of deliverance, and that's what the Holy Spirit brings. This is what must happen by revelation. This is religion B, and that is when the category of humor happens, and when you can laugh at yourself and let go and let God come. When you're not the kind of person you've been putting this big front up, but it's a big pretense, and you can't stand fooling yourself even anymore. And out of being fed up and saying, Lord, it is in me and I can't make it, God takes over. This is the ultimate hope that can happen for each person. And to that, we ought to use our educational system, we bring up our children and so on, so that kind of thing can finally happen. And that's just the structure I put on the board here so you can just see it briefly. The language which is being used here in order to get to us with this is some of the most provocative language in the history of literature. He has this gift of imagery of superb genius. Only other one that could touch him at the human level in the history of human thought is Plato, and Plato's images really fade off by comparison. He's got images that just crowd in on you, and Kierkegaard uses a number of them in getting through to you. And as a consequence, he's very much alive, and he's very much in to the fore of any kind of person thinking at all about the meaning of human existence and planet Earth. And as Becker feels, he's right in. He is a greater psychologist of man than Freud. And he says why. Is it possible to understand him now, thanks to Freud, however, which he deals with in here. But that man is continually subject to his own delusions, living under a lie, unless he is delivered from without, unless there can be the fortunate moment of grace in which he's permitted to see himself as a caricature of what he pretends to be and can laugh at himself for his pretense and come under the category of forgiveness and renewal that brings. One little paragraph from Kierkegaard that I used as a frontispiece for one of my little books, I think, pretty much carries you right to the heart of what we're going to talk about now in this chapter on him. It's from his journal, and he has just this little comment. A possibility is a hint from God. One must follow it. A possibility is a hint from God. One must follow it. Not to do so is a torment in eternity. Not to do so is a torment in eternity. To do so and to fail, that is in God's hands. Barth theologically turns this around and says, man has this word addressability, so that impossible possibility of being a son and daughter of God, of breaking through from the animality into spirit, becomes there because the word that addresses us the word of the cross, the word that is the living word in Christ, the word in the proclamation, the congregation, and its expectancy that meets us and so on, opens up that possibility and we're confronted. This is true for me. And I can no longer hold to any of the other kinds of truths and images and myths which I was protecting myself from this possibility, this hint from God. I must follow that truth which is truth for me. That's what we mean by existentialism, simply that. One of the images he uses it for, it, he says, is that the philosopher is like a man who builds a beautiful castle and lives in the doghouse alongside it. See, that calls up that whole aspect of the lie.
That's Kierkegaard also?
That's Kierkegaard, yeah. That's one of his grand little images. That's in this little thing he wrote as an introduction to Either Or, that he calls by the Greek name for what you've got in the Psalms for that little pause that you've got in Hebrew. What's the one we got in ours for Hebrew in the Psalms there? He calls them diapsilamata. I forget.
Sila.
These are just little pauses that make you think. And he's got a bunch of them. They're excellent. One of them, for instance, is, again, in this possibility. He's called into the Olympian, present the Olympian gods, to be asked what he would like from life. The last laugh. And the walls rock with laughter. They're not so prosaic as to say your wish be granted. The last laugh. Obviously, that's what you ought to want, isn't it? He strokes these in just unbelievably as he goes. But unfortunately, most of us are like the wild goose who saw the geese in the farmyard well fed and settled down with them. And then when the geese came flying north again, he found he could no longer fly. He had been tranquilized with triviality and he was ready for the butcher. These are just so much. The man who buys a man who wanted to really count and be something, and so he bought the king's own horses. But he drove them like a commoner, and they went listless through the streets.
He drove them
like a commoner, and they went listless through the streets. So he had to hire the king's coachman, and then they went like the king's horses. This is just some of the images, and he's replete with them through and through. Well. Just that little bit, so you see there's excitement ahead of you in this. It's not dull. You ask, why do we read Kierkegaard? Because he deals with me in this time so I don't get taken as a dupe by the kinds of media brainwashing that I'm continuously confronted with. I haven't even been able to look at the news things on TV while I've been out because they're nauseous, really. They're just aggravating. And I could kick my old school friend Severide in the rear because he's become like a weary North Dakota pastor moralizing in his little part, and he was a prophet during the Vietnam situation. But they're just sort of nothing left but we live with trivia. No national image, in other words, to challenge the hero in our soul. And every night ends and that's the way it is. And that's a pretty dull level. And as Will James, one of our great prophets, said, how long can man live in that level and not become destructive, self-destructive and destructive of each other? Churchill showed his genius by saying the same thing. One thing is worse than war, and that is boredom. And James says man's greatest need is a moral equivalent of war, because we cannot tolerate that kind of a level finding. None of us can finally live in that lower level and not become destructive of ourselves, of our loved ones, our lives, and of those around us. And of course, the easiest way to do that is do it as a gang. Because then it's called patriotism, and at least you get the aspect of some kind of heroism then when you knock out somebody else's country. So what we're dealing with is to the essentials of planet Earth and its salvation in a very real way. And therefore, it's worth our time to battle with some of these terms and some of these ideas that aren't easy always to get through. And it may seem, now the chapter that ended just before this chapter on the psychoanalyst Kierkegaard, he's saying that the irony of man's condition is that the deepest need is to be free of the anxiety of death and annihilation. But it is life itself which awakens it. And so we must shrink from being fully alive. In other words, if you aren't enjoying the zest and taste of life, death doesn't seem so bad. It may be a relief, right? In fact, you might seek it, and we have got suicide rates are rather high, and every kind of civilization which gives increased possibilities to be fully alive. And he speaks about the people who offer something here, Abraham Maslow, Lee Anderson, the Freudian Norman O'Brown, and so on. And he says, what exactly would it mean on this earth to be wholly unrepressed, to live in full bodily and psychic expansiveness? It can only mean to be reborn into madness, he says here. And so that's an excess of another kind. And he quotes Francis here, character traits are, so to speak, secret psychoses. And that means the way in which you guard yourself then from this being too excited about living, so you start to realize you're going to die and not be around, and you spend your time on, I'm a decent fellow, I'm a good guy, I pay my bills, I support my family, and so on. He says that this business of being a rebirth of mankind into a second innocence is, it looks like, and he goes on with Lee Anderson's here, stripped of subtle complications, that is, of all our character defenses of repression and denial and misperception of reality, who could regard the sun except with fear? And that's the way it seems to people as they confront from the level of the autonomous at the theonomous, or the level of the aesthetic at the possibility of religion be, that you're asking something that's beyond man to be. It's sort of like Meyergraf, the famous German critic, said about Van Gogh, the fool tried to paint the sun, and so he lost his brains, you see. I mean, like, that's what you're trying to do. Who can see God and die? You got to settle for a kind of, Dave Christian's word, intensive mediocrity is the only way out, as if that's what you got to settle for. You can't have that kind of greatness. It'll only be self-destructive. Better that you take a nap and forget it, like Lin Yutang said before he became a Christian, exalting the Chinese settling for that. When he gets too disturbed by a book or an idea, he just rolls over and says, time to take a nap. You settle for tranquility. Lin Yutang got caught out too and became a Christian later. But I'm nobody, who are you? You nobody too? You know? Remember that from one of our famous women poets? And so we settle for being nobodies. Quotes from Søren Kierkegaard. The whole order of things fills me with a sense of anguish. From the nap to the mysteries of incarnation, all is entirely unintelligible to me, and particularly my own person. Great is my sorrow without limits. None knows of it except God in heaven, and he cannot have pity. I mean, when you're settling for that sort of a level, you're going to hold on to tranquility in this lower base, and yet you're constantly aware there's more. And yet, why be deceived by it? It's only going to drive you out of your tranquility. You won't be able to sleep. Today, we can call Kierkegaard a psychoanalyst without fear of being laughed at, or at least with confidence that the scoffers are uninformed. In the last few decades, a new discovery of Kierkegaard has been taking place, and that's long since I've left college this has happened. When I was in college, Lee Holland had a few things on Kierkegaard from Oklahoma, and there was just nothing of him in English at all. David Swenson's trying to get a little bit in, and since that, of course, we've had an immense publication thing here, and the Hongs have been in the midst of it, as some of you know. And it's been exciting, because Muggeridge, this lifelong laugh of great scoffing about Christianity, reviewed the Hong's journals on Kierkegaard, and he gets hooked, and he's become a Christian 68. It's dangerous between that and this beautiful sister Teresa down in Calcutta. We used to think there was a strict difference between science and belief, and that psychiatry and religion were consequently far apart. But now we find that psychiatric and religious perspectives on reality are intimately related. For one thing, they grow out of one another historically, as we shall see in a later section. Even more importantly, by now they reinforce one another. Psychiatric experience and religious experience cannot be separated, either subjectively in the person's own eyes or objectively in the theory of character development. And he says, nowhere is this merger of religious and psychiatric categories clearer than in the work of Kierkegaard. But he says it's the work of the atheist Freud, peculiarly enough, that allows us to see the scientific stature of the theologian Kierkegaard's work. So only then do we have the clinical evidence to support it. Now, he makes a point here which I think is important for us to know in this chapter. He's quoting a psychologist, Maurer, Freud had to live and write before the earlier work of Kierkegaard could be correctly understood and appreciated. Then he goes on to say that I'm not going to attempt to repeat and decode Kierkegaard's breathtakingly penetrating and often difficult to understand analysis of the human condition. He understands this earlier Kierkegaard, and this essay is excellent. Howard Hong and I both agreed we don't think anything in English is better on the earlier Kierkegaard. However, he didn't leave things there, and he will say some comments here and in Escape from Evil that indicates his ignorance of the kind of development that Kierkegaard has. And this is something that all of you are going to be ahead of him as soon as you've gotten into Works of Love. This book is the first book that Kierkegaard signed with his own name. Before that, he's been playing games with you, and very sophisticated games under different names, and the names are answering each other, in which, as he declares, he believes he's taken every position possible contrary to Christianity that's possible to take, at least in the realm of logic, which up till the advent, I suppose, of contemporary science is true. And he's tried to expose them and their inadequacy, really, and part of the decoding is there. But like, for instance, he'll use Kierkegaard's Night of Faith, which is from Fear and Trembling, one of the pseudonyms that wrote that. And the Night of Faith is a man who is going about the ordinary trivia of the day, but underneath burns this passion that is visible only to God, and that's it. Both Barth gets taken the same way. He doesn't get beyond that either, and then thinks he's leaving Kierkegaard from behind when all he's doing is catching up with him in his later works. And I've checked this out with a number of the good scholars in Europe who agree that this is right, as my analysis is correct here. Works of Love is where the living Christ comes into the picture. And this is hard to deal with when you're writing books on psychiatry and so on, to deal with the living Christ as an editorial to the editor when the letters in Time here in the last election said we're soon going to be ruled by a crazy man who's getting his instructions from a man who's been 2,000 years dead. You know, well, that's the way it looks at that level, you know. And introducing the living Christ as the one who is the dynamic of the situation, the one who is, as those who've been subject to Hong's lectures know, creating that continuous triangle of the neighbor, so that in the wife and the sister and the child and the friend, there is continuously the neighbor, because that's what Christ is doing. So the mystery of the other is continually being invoked and provoked, and the excitement of life is a very real thing under that continuous work of Jesus Christ, who's making that person the other, the neighbor, the thou, and no longer an it, to use the way Buber has pulled this out and used it. And all these people who were included have been very much affected by this. Buber, too, does not know the older Kierkegaard. The older Kierkegaard writing in this has not got the excitement of a lot of that imagery. It's tougher going. And somehow they have missed it. But as he says here on this, and it's true, he says what he's going to do now, what I want to do instead of decoding and so on, is to try to present a summing up of the main argument contained in the psychological works as pointedly and sparingly as possible, so that the reader can see in a nutshell what Kierkegaard was driving at. If I can do this without getting too involved, because fascinated by Kierkegaard's genius, the reader should be struck by the result. And you are. He's gotten this down, really. The structure of Kierkegaard's understanding of man is almost exactly a recap of the modern clinical picture of man we have sketched in the first four chapters of this book. The reader can then judge for himself how congruent the two pictures are at basic points, even though I don't present Kierkegaard in a stunning detail. Why it is that we are today comparing Kierkegaard's stature in psychology to Freud's, and why I and others are prepared to call Kierkegaard so great a student of the human condition as was Freud. The fact is that already in the 1840s he was already post-Freudian, which conveys the eternal uncanniness of genius. In other words, he's already gone beyond him. And his understanding of man, then, as a union of opposites, this continual conflict situation, which Mugford says is the essence of Luther in his development of Western man, and seeing him in this continuous conflict situation of flesh and spirit, of life organized around the ego and so sunk in on yourself, turned in upon oneself. This is Luther's category for those first two basic ones. In advertis ad se, you're turned in on yourself, you can't escape the ego and its continuous cloud that surrounds you, and so you're living as though you were some atomization of a human being and others are not really real about you. And you are broken in that when you see yourself as spirit, when there is a hunger for more, when the tragedy of your loneliness and your alienation hits you and you reach out for that more. That is where spirit comes, and spirit always is produced in the forgiveness of sins. It's in the forgiveness of sins that man becomes spirit. This is Luther and Kierkegaard both. That's when they put the possibility of not being simply an isolated ego, but being in a community of spirit in which the other becomes a neighbor in his mystery and wonder, with whom you continually interchange, Christ himself meeting you in that interchange. He himself refreshing, feeding, and as we mentioned last night's sermon, making you the individual, the particular, the named person, because this is how you two relate, and Christ himself making that relation possible. But this continual kind of composite, of opposites, of flesh and spirit, is what man is ever since the fall. That he is no longer in that unconscious identity with God, in which his own death was not a threat, in which he lived simply at the level of innocence. But now he has this capacity to reflect on his condition. He can become conscious of himself in his own internalization in the way no animal life does. And this paradox is the really constant thing about man in all periods of history and society. This is the only man we know from our understanding of all the texts that he's left behind and all the contexts in which he's lived. It is the true essence of man, he says, as Fromm has said. This has become the cornerstone, he says, of all modern psychologists. But Kierkegaard already counseled them, further than this psychology cannot go. And moreover, it can verify this point again and again in its observation of human life. It can't get beyond that. It cannot enter into the mystery of faith. It cannot analyze and confront us with the reality of the Holy Spirit and how he functions, etc., in order to create man as spirit and in community, so that we are able to be both in the individual to whom Kierkegaard constantly talks and whom he constantly strengthens in his individuality, and yet made that individual only in a community of the other, who is the neighbor, in whom Christ himself confronts him. And so this continual awareness of man in his privacy, enriched by the other in community, and giving himself back out of that enrichment to enrich the community again. This continual give and take that we know as Holden Village and its fellowship these years, in which every authentic live parish that isn't playing games is knowing. And this Otto Rank spent his last years writing up and saying, man is a theological being. He cannot be subject to psychological analysis. He is theological in his dimensions. And only that which comes from without, that which is given, that which is proclaimed, that which comes by revelation, can allow the spirit to break through, so that man realizes that he is not simply finite, but infinite in his possibilities. Infinite, as we put in our Lutheran dogmatics, I think rather delightful. Luther says, each man is a Schauplatz. He's the theater. That arena in which there is a continuous conflict between God and the powers of evil. And in that there's this continuous conflict because man is created infinite in his hunger for beauty, infinite in his capacity for love, infinite in his thirst for knowledge, infinite in his potential for eternal life, for he's in the image of God. And when man takes that infinite image and tries to satisfy it with a finite lust, all that can happen is, of course, is explosion and destruction, you see. Because this is what he is. And he can't belie that situation and make himself a nice little guy with a good character who's paying his bills, who takes care of his family, and who's already paying his insurance, so nobody else is going to have to pay to bury him. And don't trouble me. Let me alone. like has been put beautifully by this German novelist and dramatist in his drama on Bertolt Brecht at the time of the 57 revolt of the workers in Berlin. And Brecht says, on with the play is the thing. They're doing a play on Coriolanus. So this is a play within the play, just as that was. And then when the workers' revolution has been put down and he in no way let himself get near where the action was, all these empty soldiers are facing him, these beer bottles that he's been drinking, or so, and he's soliloquizing and he says, the Holy Spirit breathed, and I mistook it for a draft and cried, who's come here to molest me? And that's man when he settles for flesh and will not be spirit, you see. The Holy Spirit breathed, and I mistook it for a draft and cried, who's come here to molest me? I was thinking of Ed Woods, that the guy that I was teamed up with the church to go to all the CCC camps and talk to guys, and he was sort of the bait on the hook, and then I had a chance to talk about 7 minutes. He told a few jokes and a little bit about character, because he always went to church after football games. And he was an All-American tackle, unbelievable. He was huge, and he moved with the lithesomeness of some of you gals on a dance floor. Wave his hips a little bit, and three guys would hit each other trying to tackle him, and he'd just keep going. You know, he was quite an athlete. And Ed, when I finally, my talks were getting through to him, he says, you know, I got to talk to you about this. Nope, if I do, I won't sleep. And that's this conflict situation. Now, this fall into self-consciousness, the emergence from comfortable ignorance in nature, had one great penalty for man. It gave him dread or anxiety, angst, Anfechtung, or some of these foreign words. And I would say part of the health of the Semischone is the guys meet each other in the hall and say, well, how's your angst going today? And the other one will say, oh, my Anfechtung is on the up and up, you know. And I used to say, we've made graveyard theologies out of this sometimes, and I always took my classes, I'd always sing about Sweet Rosie O'Grady. Sometimes when you're lecturing, you got to wake them up, and I'd sing, Sweet Rosie O'Grady was a blacksmith's daughter by birth. She got tired of living and wanted to get off this earth. She tried dying by inches, but dying by inches was hard. That's sort of that dying that they do around seminary. So she went out in the alley, and there she died by the yard, you know. And that's, when you get confronted in this way, as we'll see, it's a bust-up. It's a breakdown. It's bankruptcy. See? And there's no way out. And this is what he's driving you into here. And this is what makes this a little hard reading. One does not find dread in the beast, says Kierkegaard, precisely for the reason that by nature the beast is not qualified by spirit. For spirit reads self for symbolic inner identity. This beast has none. It is ignorant, says Kierkegaard, therefore innocent. But man is a synthesis of the soulish and bodily, and so experiences anxiety. Again, for soulish, who must read self-conscious. If man, he quotes here, if man were a beast or an angel, he would not be able to be in dread. That is, if you're entirely unconscious or totally an animal. Since he is a synthesis, he can be in dread. Man himself produces dread. Man's anxiety is a function of his sheer ambiguity and his complete powerlessness to overcome that ambiguity, to be straightforwardly an animal or an angel. He cannot live heedless of his fate, nor can take sure control of that fate and triumph over it by being outside the human condition. Think of Sue's lecture the other night, some of the kids, you know, the questions there of Sean and so on. Think of how when you were a child and spirit started coming, as you realized this awesome dread that people die, maybe your parents are going to die. And where was I before I was born? What's going to happen to me when I die, you know? And these reflective questions begin, not when we go to a church college, but they come quite naturally to children before they even get into the school system. The school system does its best, of course, to drain them out of them with triviality. But they're there. They're built into us as human. Man's anxiety is a function of his sheer ambiguity and of his complete powerlessness to overcome that ambiguity, to be straightforwardly an animal or an angel. He cannot live heedless of his fate, nor can he take sure control over that fate and triumph over it by being outside the human condition. The spirit cannot do away with itself. Self-consciousness cannot disappear. Neither can man sink down into a vegetative life. Be wholly an animal, he cannot flee from dread. But the real focus of dread is not the ambiguity itself, it is the result of the judgment the judgment on man, that God, he has eaten of the fruit of tree of knowledge, and God says, thou shalt surely die. In other words, the final terror of self-consciousness is the knowledge of one's own death, which is the peculiar sentence on man alone in the animal kingdom. This is the meaning of the Garden of Eden myth and the rediscovery of modern psychology, that death is man's peculiar and greatest anxiety. See, it's this moment where we're having real conversation with the communist world today, incidentally, because you can't live with any kind of motivation for 10 generations from now. We'll finally get rid of the dictatorship and have only the dictatorship of the proletariat. You're more and more aware that maybe that's a fiction and misreading the nature of man and his conflict situation, too. And meanwhile, you perish. So Kierkegaard's whole understanding of man's character is that it is a structure built up to avoid perception of the terror, perdition, and annihilation that dwell next door to every man. And all of his life has different strategies to do this. And we just described a little bit of up here in terms of this asceticism and ethics and religion A. And so he lives in a half obscurity. He's shut up. He won't let anything get near him. And he mentions here the studies of Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Tillich and so on. This, you've been involved here and will be with Paul Turney and others at the and with Jacques Ellul and others at the lay level who are doing a good job of doing just then. Stringfellow, William Stringfellow, another. Now he writes, a partisan of the most rigid orthodoxy knows it all. He bows before the holy truth. For the holy truth is for him an ensemble of ceremonies. He talks about presenting himself before the throne of God, of how many times one must bow. He knows everything the same way as does the pupil, who's able to demonstrate a mathematical proposition of the letters ABC. But now when they're changed to DEF, he's therefore in dread whenever he has something not arranged in the same order. So the phrases have to come the same way, or else you're disturbing us, Pastor. You see, because we should get this litany of the usual and not have to think when we come to church. We come there to be comforted and go away in peace. These are the letters I used to get on my vacation from my church council when I was in a parish. But they, and this kind of shut-upness, see, closing yourself, is what we're doing. We use the church to help us in this. Take your troubles to church. Millions leave them there. You know, and you go out satisfied, happy guy. Mary took that one through one of the Founders Day lectures at St. Olaf, a tremendous lecture. But this shut-upness and so on, we can't get by with it. And this is what he deals with here, and parents helping children and so on, that what you want to do is to bring children into the invincible morale of the kingdom, where they can live with the possibility and not live in a fake way with it. So they can live in such a way that they don't have to live under the power of the lie. So they're involved. Now, I would say here, a great novel that is now available again in paperback and being on paperback, I notice, is by the perhaps best of our Lutheran writers in this century, Martin A. Hansen, H-A-N-S-E-N, a Dane. And it's The Liar. And it's a poetic wonder. It's a beautiful novel. It's not long. It's well done. It's by a teacher. He's keeping his journal. And he calls it The Liar because he realizes as a teacher, he has succeeded in doing what Kierkegaard says every professor manages to do, and that's to talk about reality without ever getting mixed up with it, to live in always in doubt but never in error, to be free from the entanglements of life, to end an observer of the human situation. Well, that's a good book, but the lie has been made a great deal of in all of our continental theologies. This is a category that they speak of a great deal. You don't hear much about it in the English-speaking world, unfortunately, or our preaching would be quite different. He's got, a good paragraph here on describing the mass man that comes, and he uses the category of immediacy for this. And if you've been reading a little bit of Edna Hong, she's been introducing you to this category, too, as one of our great women theologians that we feel is an answered prayer. But I'll just read a little bit of this. Kierkegaard gives us some portrait sketches of the styles of denying possibility, or the lies of character, which is the same thing. He's intent on describing what we today call inauthentic men who avoid developing their own uniqueness. They follow out the styles of automatic and uncritical living in which they were conditioned as children. They are inauthentic in that they do not belong to themselves, are not their own person, do not act from their own center, do not see reality on its terms. In fact, they've gotten a good education this through the American public school system, which aims at doing this. They call this adapting, you know. They are the one-dimensional men, totally immersed in the fictional games being played in their society, unable to transcend their social conditioning. The corporation men in the West, the bureaucrats in the East. I got a good poem on this. It's really a good poem, which Paul has got up in his, well, I should put it out to you sometime. It just shows this and where reality is a possibility of breaking through is a poem. The tribal men locked up in tradition. Man everywhere who doesn't understand what it means to think for himself, and who, if he did, would shrink back at the idea of such audacity and exposure. If you are going to ask that question, you do not belong at the seminary. One of my brother-in-laws ended up in the law school on that one. You don't show any individuation. We oftentimes have students coming to our seminary with ideas of their own, but when they go out, they have our print. Oh, how did he put it?
Stamp.
Yeah, Gilligan said, our stamp on them. That was the president of my seminary when I came there, because I'd come from St. Olaf College, which had a theory of freedom, and suddenly discovered that as a seminarian, as a junior, I wasn't even allowed to go hear Kagawa or I would be dismissed from the seminary. And Kagawa was talking five blocks away. So I went in to see him and I said, why don't you just produce records and send them out? We didn't have tapes in those days. Now we're doing it with tapes, aren't we? Kierkegaard gives us a description then of mass man here with these words. He's the immediate man. His self, or he himself, is something included along with the other in the compass of the temporal and the worldly. Thus the self coheres immediately with the other, wishing, desiring, enjoying, etc., but passively. In other words, an echo. He manages to imitate the other men, noting how they manage to live, and so he too lives after a sort. You know, this is your image making. In Christendom, he too is a Christian, goes to church every Sunday, hears and understands the parson. Yea, they understand one another. He dies. The parson introduces him into eternity for the price of $10. But a self he was not, and a self he did not become. For the immediate man does not recognize himself. He recognizes himself only by his dress. He recognizes that he has a self only by external. What is the great play that was modeled on this? The inspiration for it. It's one of the great ones for the hour, and you're still producing around sometimes on college campuses. You're going to have the other one of those two twins produced this year, because Fritz has got, I think he said, 15 or 18 copies of bronze along. Peer Gynt, see, his Gyntishness, remember? And this is a description of that. He never becomes himself. Remember the button maker comes? Yeah. He's trying to prove one time he must have been himself. All he was a reaction to his environment. Heidegger deals with this. This is what he calls inauthentic, because they're always thinking of Das Mann. Das Mann in German is the what will they think? What will they think? What will they think? What will they think? And our Lord responds to that by saying, how can you then believe if you seek honor of each other and seek not the honor which is from the only God? That's John 5:44, in case you haven't seen it, the verse. So this is a perfect description of the automatic cultural man. Man is confined by culture, a slave to it, who imagines that he has an identity if he pays his insurance premium, that he has control of his life if he guns his sports car or works his electric toothbrush. Today, the inauthentic or immediate men are familiar types after decades of Marxist and existentialist analysis of man's slavery to his social system. But in Kierkegaard's time, it must have been a shock to a modern European city dweller and be considered a Philistine at the same time. Mm-hmm. For Kierkegaard, Philistinism was triviality. Man lulled by the daily routines of his society, content with the satisfactions that it offers him. In today's world, the car, the shopping center, the two-week summer vacation. Man is protected by the secure and limited alternatives his society offers him, and if he does not look up from his path, he can live out his life with a certain dull security. Devoid of imagination, as the Philistine always is, he lives in a certain trivial province of experience as to how things go, what is possible, what usually occurs. Philistinism tranquilizes itself in the trivial. That's a quote he uses there. See? Great line. Tranquilizes itself in the trivial. Why does man accept to live a trivial life? Because of the danger of the full horizon of experience, of course. This is the deeper motivation of Philistinism, that it celebrates the triumph over possibility, over freedom. Philistinism knows its real enemy. Freedom is dangerous. If you follow it too willingly, it threatens to pull you into the air. If you give it up too wholly, you become a prisoner of necessity. The safest thing is to toe the mark of what is socially possible. And here's Kierkegaard's quote he uses there. For Philistinism thinks that it is in control of possibility, thinks that when it is decoyed this prodigious elasticity into the field of probability or into the madhouse, it holds it a prisoner. It carries possibility around like a prisoner in the cage of the probable, shows it off. In other words, it just lives in a daydream. And nothing real happens.
That last quote is Kierkegaard?
Yeah.
Could you read it again?
Yeah. Philistinism thinks it is in control of possibility. It thinks that when it's decoyed this prodigious elasticity into the field of probability, that is sometime, tomorrow, into the madhouse, or into the madhouse, it holds it a prisoner. It has control of it. One of the tremendous things was reading the book that he's largely quoting from here aloud once in 1964 here in the summer, as Howard is putting out a new and better translation of it, and the fellow who built our hydro plant had been under severe psychiatric treatment, a schizo, unable to relate, unable to talk. His grandfather died. He asked for permission just to go off by himself and hike and be able to weep that day on it. He wasn't very communicable. At that time, Paul, a lot younger, used to go out and work beside him, and they got a little buddy system going, and they followed Paul into this discussion on this particular book by Howard Hong, and that began a breakthrough. This person into where now he talks a great deal, excellent salary, and I hope he comes up here because he's still a bachelor. Still a bachelor, that's all I want to say. I'm just giving that for all of you possibilities on other levels. But he's a great person, by the way. He speaks about those who think they can get out of possibility into impossibility, instead of what Karl Barth always likes to call the impossible possibility, they get into the impossible. A friend of mine, in a moment of revival at our seminary, we had a group together, and he said, I am a captive balloon. Sin is the anchor that holds me to the ground. And I said, Herman, hang on to the anchor. And he didn't. He left, and we had to have him 3 months in a rest home. And he came out working me on the farm that summer when I was truck farming. But these people kind of forget. They're gods. They don't have that quality at all. See, they're just pure spirit. Run off on that side. He speaks about that. They forget this kind of a synthesis. He deals with this here. And he says he could just as well have written Ronald Lang's The Divided South, because that's what he was writing a year, a century ago, so on this kind of a breakdown. I'll read just this one little quote from him on page 78. But in spite of the fact that a man has become fantastic in this fashion, he may nevertheless be perfectly well able to live on, to be a man, as it seems, to occupy himself with temporal things, get married, beget children with honor and esteem, and perhaps no one notices that in a deeper sense he lacks a self. He's just a Walter Mitty in a dream life. There's no real self. Or again, I'll read another quote here. But while one sort of despair plunges wildly into the infinite and loses itself, a second sort permits itself, as it were, to be defrauded by the others, by seeing the multitude of men about, by getting engaged in all sorts of worldly affairs, by becoming wise about how things go in this world. Such a man forgets himself, does not dare to believe in himself, finds it too venturesome a thing to be himself, far easier and safer to be like others, to become an imitation, a number, a cipher in the crowd. Like Barth said about this for himself, how fortunate it was he wasn't a pastor in America. He would have been so busy, he would have never known he was bankrupt. As it was, he was a country preacher at Saffron Well, and when Saturday night came, he knew he didn't have anything really to say the next morning, and something could happen. The same thing for Archbishop Soderblom that I've quoted to you on that. If one will compare the tendency to run wild in possibility with the efforts of a child to enunciate words, the lack of possibility is like being dumb, for without possibility, man cannot, as it were, draw breath. And he becomes like a dumb herd person. He lives out his life now in the cult of sports and at that level, where he's a mass man living off his TV. Well, I wanted to just introduce you a little bit to that, but I'm going to spread ourselves over. What time is it? I don't have my... Oh, no. Well, we got to quit. But I think if you would read, especially, I was going to read here on page 90 and so on at the conclusion, I won't. The possibilities of anxiety are that here is the eternal spring for growth into new dimensions of thought and trust. Faith poses a new life task, the adventure in openness to a multidimensional reality. The life with awe and mystery, again, becomes a daily possibility.
And you have this continuous newness of being, as he goes on to say on page 200 and on, of the gospel making you always young. Young and whole. Or here he even has it here, quote at the end of 91. Not that faith annihilates dread, but remaining ever young, it is continually developing itself out of the death throe of dread. In other words, it's continually bouncing back from that aspect of flesh into spirit, and it lives continually anew in the gift that is of God himself and the forgiveness of sins, and in his gift of himself always giving the other as neighbor, and himself in the other as neighbor. And this is the life together that becomes the impossible possibility for this creature that was sort of made for self-destruction. But God has a greater purpose for each of us, fortunately. Any question, conclusion? You've got to run to something else. I suppose the others are gone that were going there. I'm sorry I went over. I didn't have it here.
Carol, at the end of the, he's talking about, it sounds like he's talking about two defenses against possibility. One is to just forget it, to let it be, go away. And the other one is to go wild.
Exactly, yeah. He deals with both sides. Yeah.
So then he's talking, he himself too, then, is talking about attention in this area.
Yeah, exactly.
One can't capture it either way. Then.
No,
you go either way is to capture it. Right?
Yeah. That's why finally you are found only in taking your life from God's hand. This place, this person, this time, in wonder, in thanks. And continually new find it because you're pouring back into God's hand the totality of your existence, from whom comes every good and perfect gift. So he asks with beautiful penetration to one little hint that I got tonight in the lovely little vespers that we had, but for instance, how do you deal with bitterness? You put it back into God's hand and take it from him. And then in that, you learn something new about yourself and the human situation, and you live with thanks. Have you done this? Yes. Have you done this? Then, too, you found this a good and perfect gift. And why you finally have to bounce, you see. Like the first time when when our church merged the ALC and they didn't want me around, and so I was in exile then and had, of course, a kind of nice deal. I was being paid $1,000 a month in first class each way for me and my family to enjoy study in Denmark. But the Lord did that through the government, not the church. But when they had a farewell for me, I said, I'm too young to die, because they all had me retiring then. I was just, my mid-40s. And I kind of liked a few years left. But the fellow was chairman. He says, always remember, it isn't how far you fall, but how high you bounce. And that sums up life, you see, in that category under the concept, I think, pretty well.
Now, I've got a question.
Yes.
You talked about how schools teach children triviality, trying to get them to empty themselves of this wonder that's in them.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what you suggest we as Christian teachers, what our goal is in educating in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, like when I'm teaching the little kids up here, I teach music for elementary school.
Yeah.
You know, what's my purpose? What am I... what am I supposed to be doing along these lines?
Well, fortunately, God has put the laboratory next to us all, hasn't he? And it's right there. The minute you get outside the sameness of a room, you're into the absolutely absurd multiplicity of unsameness that is his world, that Barbara talked to a little bit in the human scene, but it's all over the place, isn't it? He's crazy. He's no mathematician, whatever. It isn't just one apple to produce another tree that comes off an apple tree, but we're all eating them, aren't we? His whole way of every snowdrop different and so on. When we moved to Minneapolis, we bought our house because it would be in a mixed neighborhood. And we wanted that. We did not want a suburb. It also made possibility for me times to even walk downtown from there. And there was walking distance to the then public library, very easy. Also got to be even closer walking distance to Guthrie, as it turned out. But we chose it because to go to their school, the kids would have to go around Lake of the Isles four times a day. And whatever they got in school, we figured to have a good chance of filtering out on their way to and from it. That not even one day was the same, and much less 2 days. Then the crazy city, at the same time that I took possession of my house, passed a council motion, in which my side of the street had to go over to school. It's no longer there. They've torn it down over in Franklin, because there aren't that many kids around. It's all young adults in our area of the world, pretty much there. And so they couldn't maintain that school, but it was maintained through these years, much in these years we've been there. And I didn't want our kids to go there because they walked along Franklin. They wouldn't begin to. It'd be a lot of traffic and a few different cars there, but not much. And so I went over to see the principal over at the other school. His name was Afterath. Mr. Afterath happened to be president of the Elementary School Teachers of America. I didn't know that. I just said to him, I happen to have five children. That's all I had then. I've been more blessed by the Lord since. But I said, I have five kids. There's nothing particularly extraordinary about them except they're all different. And with good luck and a good Lord, I hope to keep them that way. And I said, I bought this house so that they would have to go around Lake Dallas four times a day, and they'd know that whatever your school does to them, God hasn't got that kind of world for them to go and live in. I said, I make no bones about it. I hate the American school system for its attempt to make everybody adaptable and nice and relate to each other. And he had a good big belly laughing. He says, I read you entirely. My wife's a Pentecostal preacher. We have nine kids. There will be room in our school for you, which was a great elementary school, by the way. But this, you have to know that you're doing this. You're fighting the system all the time to make room for the individuality of those kids, aren't you? And you do have to fight this. Mary?
Well, I was just going to say that that still didn't answer her question as far as
well,
what she should do. And I do think that a teacher who herself has vision and imagination is bound to affect the kids. I mean, no system can control a teacher who is an independent self. And I think that the American school system has a lot of good things about it. It isn't all bad. It's just so that I just wish they'd get back to learning to read and write and simple few things like that. But I do believe that it's the teachers that our children have had that have been the formative influences on them as persons. And I think that's what you teachers are. You young teachers don't realize what a terrific emphasis and what a terrific influence you have on kids. Just by the quality of your being. See what I mean? I mean, it isn't
absolutely. The
method or what have you. That helps. I mean, all of that is part of teaching. But it's the kind of person you are in your imagination and your humor and your love of the kids and your love of God's world that all comes in. Wham!
On Roosevelt Road, in the 30s, I went through the case histories of one of the centers there in doing sociological work. And here was this family in this area that's unbelievably awful, and it's leveling down, and it's degenerative power on the kids. Rape, families forcing their own siblings into early sex, all the rest of the rot of that kind of thing. And here was this lovely story of a girl then at the University of Chicago Art Institute, a second grade teacher, had caught her imagination. Her world had become that second grade teacher. And that was the leverage out of that. That was it. And that had carried her out of that whole foul mess to where she was even then at the Art Institute school at Chicago Art Institute. And that I just thought the influence of one person. I had a Mrs. DeLue in 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. Unbelievable. Boy, what a good teacher. And then she got my sister. She said, my, how your mother must enjoy you too, and how different you are. And I said, my mother has never even noticed the difference. She hadn't. She was still, uncertain about her feeling about me. She dressed me like a girl, called me Carol, and she was quite startled when just now I was telling her, I've always had a hand tremor, mother, because she was fussing about her hand tremor a little bit. I said, I've had one all my life, because I'd asked her earlier this summer if I was born left-handed, and she said yes, but not for long. And she's never even noticed I've got a hand tremor, which is one of the most obvious things everybody knows about me right away. So you can have mother be that unaware of you, but you've got teachers that know you're there, you know? And they do, fortunately. Well, I think this answers something of our situation. It's more to it. You will see how beautifully Luther, Kierkegaard, and Becker will come into focus from this brief 9 days we've got ahead of us till we go. It's too fast and it's too much, and some that you'll be living with later, unfortunately, be reflected and come back at you again. But these categories of the lie with which all of them are dealing, which is the self-deception that we keep in order to hold on to our tranquility, and so we never become spirit, is the thing that you see so clearly from this. And Karen here was speaking about the movie the other night, and I was talking about a conversation I had with a man who'd spent 3 months in Moscow studying theater there in the embassy in Denmark. Asked me to meet with him and talk with him, so to help him relate his experiences to back in New York, where he owns the Lincoln Theater, which is something like Guthrie in Minneapolis. And we had a really great talk, because what we were aware of is that theater, good art, presents you only with the tragic alienation, the isolation, yourself at war with yourself. This it does do, but it doesn't give you anything of the answer. That has to come from the proclamation. But it should prepare you for a real proclamation, so that when you go to church, something happens, and you're trying to put on theater there. But you do get the word of the Lord that has to come from without, you see, in order to meet your human situation and transform it. And that's what all he's doing. And this is what Becker said all along. It has to come from without, has to come from above. The rescue has to be from the transcendent, from the other, from God. But if you spell that out in terms of even if a teacher is going to do this and teach someone, you just make it into a kind of moralism, you see, or the theater loses its whole spunk. Because it can only present the tragedy of the human situation. And that's all psychology can do. And that's what Otto Rank is saying. See, that's all it can do. You can analyze the situation, but you cannot paint the shining vision. The shining vision that draws us out of our situation into the truly human has to come from the reflection that we have of God in the face of Jesus Christ, where we see our humanity made visible for us. Apart from the image of Jesus, we don't really have an image of what it means to be human.